sofa that miraculously transformed itself at night into a large, comfortable bed. Mother stayed in Los Angeles long enough to get us settled. Then she returned to San Francisco to arrange living accommodations for her abruptly enlarged family. Mama and Bailey, he joined us a month after our arrival, and I lived in Los Angeles about 6 months while our permanent living arrangements were being concluded. Daddy Bailey visited occasionally, bringing shopping bags of fruit. He shone like a sun god, benignly warming and brightening his dark subjects. Since I was enchanted with the creation of my own world, years had to pass before I reflected on Mama's remarkable adjustment to that foreign life. An old Southern Negro woman who had lived her life under the left breast of her community learned to deal with white landlords, Mexican neighbors, and Negro strangers. She shopped in supermarkets larger than the town she came from. She dealt with accents that must have struck jarringly on her ears. She, who had never been more than 50 miles from her birthplace, learned to traverse the maze of Spanish-named streets in that enigma that is Los Angeles. She made the same kinds of friends she had always had. On late Sunday afternoons, before evening church services, old women, who were carbon copies of herself, came to the apartment to share leftovers from the Sunday meal and religious talk of a bright hereafter. When the arrangements for our move north were completed, she broke the shattering news that she was going back to Arkansas. She had done her job. She was needed by Uncle Willie. We had our own parents at last. At least we were in the same state. There were foggy days of unknowing for Bailey and me. It was all well and good to say we would be with our parents. But after all, who were they? Would they be more severe with our didos than she? That would be bad. Or more lax, which would be even worse. Would we learn to speak that fast language? I doubted that. And I doubted even more that I would ever find out what they laughed about so loudly and so often. I would have been willing to return to Stamps even without Bailey, but Mama left for Arkansas without me. Her solid air packed around her like cotton. Mother drove us toward San Francisco over the big white highway that would not have surprised me had it never ended. She talked incessantly and pointed out places of interest. As we passed Capistrano, she sang a popular song that I'd heard on the radio, "When the Swallows Come Back to Capistrano." She strung humorous stories along the road, like a bright wash, and tried to captivate us. But her being, and her being our mother, had done the job so successfully that it was a little distracting to see her throwing good energy after good. The big car was obedient under her one hand driving, and she pulled on her lucky strike so hard that her cheeks were sucked in to make valleys in her face. Nothing could have been more magical than to have found her at last and have her solely to ourselves in the closed world of a moving car. Although we were both enraptured, neither Bailey nor I was unaware of her nervousness. The knowledge that we had the power to upset that goddess made us look at each other conspiratorially and smile. It also made her human. We spent a few dingy months in an Oakland apartment which had a bathtub in the kitchen and was near enough to the Southern Pacific mole to shake at the arrival and departure of every train. In many ways, it was St. Louis revisited, along with Uncles Tommy and Billy, and Grandmother Baxter of the pince-nez and strict carriage, was again in residence. Though the mighty Baxter clan had fallen into hard times after the death of Grandfather Baxter some years earlier. We went to school, and no family member questioned the output or quality of our work. We went to a playground which sported a basketball court, a football field, and ping-pong tables under awnings. On Sundays, instead of going to church, we went to the movies. I slept with Grandmother Baxter, who was afflicted with chronic bronchitis and smoked heavily. During the day, she stubbed out half-finished cigarettes and put them in an ashtray beside her bed. At night, when she woke up coughing, she fumbled in the dark for a butt. She called them willies. And after a blaze of light, she smoked the strengthened tobacco until her irritated throat was deadened with nicotine. For the first few weeks of sleeping with her, the shaking bed and the scent of tobacco woke me, but I readily became used to it and slept peacefully through the night. One evening, after going to bed normally, I awoke to another kind of shaking. In the blunted light, through the window shade, I saw my mother kneeling by my bed. She brought her face close to my ear. "Riti," she whispered, "Riti, come, but be very quiet." Then she quietly rose and left the room. Dutifully, and in a haze of ponderment, I followed. Through the half-open kitchen door, the light showed Bailey's pajamaed legs dangling from the covered bathtub. The clock on the dining room table said 2:30. I had never been up at that hour. I looked Bailey a question, and he returned a sheepish gaze. I knew immediately that there was nothing to fear. Then I ran my mind through the catalog of important dates. It wasn't anybody's birthday, or April Fool's Day, or Halloween, but it was something. Mother closed the kitchen door and told me to sit beside Bailey. She put her hands on her hips and said we had been invited to a party. Was that enough to wake us in the middle of the night? Neither of us said anything. She continued, "I'm giving a party, and you are my honored and only guests." She opened the oven and took out a pan of her crispy brown biscuits and showed us a pot of milk chocolate on the back of the stove. There was nothing for it but to laugh at our beautiful and wild mother. When Bailey and I started laughing, she joined in, except that she kept her fingers in front of her mouth to try to quiet us. We were served formally, and she apologized for having no orchestra to play for us, but said she'd sing as a substitute. She sang and did the time step and the snake hips and the Susie Q. What child can resist a mother who laughs freely and often, especially if the child's wit is mature enough to catch the sense of the joke? Mother's beauty made her powerful, and her power made her unflinchingly honest. When we asked her what she did, what her job was, she walked us to Oakland's 7th Street, where dusty bars and smoke shops sat in the laps of storefront churches. She pointed out Raincoat's Pinochle Parlor and Slim Jenkins' pretentious saloon. Some nights she played pinochle for money, or ran a poker game at Mother Smith's, or stopped at Slim's for a few drinks. She told us that she had never cheated anybody and wasn't making any preparations to do so. Her work was as honest as a job held by fat Mrs. Walker, a maid who lived next door to us, and a damn sight better paid. She wouldn't bust suds for anybody, nor be anyone's kitchen bitch. The good Lord gave her a mind, and she intended to use it to support her mother and her children. She didn't need to add and have a little fun along the way. In the street, people were genuinely happy to see her. "Hey, baby, what's the news?" "Everything's steady, baby, steady." "How you doing, pretty?" "I can't win 'cause of the shape I'm in," said with a laugh that belied the content. "You all right, mama?" "Oh, they tell me the white folks still in the lead," said as if this was not quite the whole truth. She supported us efficiently with humor and imagination. Occasionally, we were taken to Chinese restaurants or Italian pizza parlors. We were introduced to Hungarian goulash and Irish stew. Through food, we learned that there were other people in the world. With all her jollity, Vivian Baxter had no mercy. There was a saying in Oakland at the time, which, if she didn't say it herself, explained her attitude. The saying was, "Sympathy is next to shit in the dictionary, and I can't even read." Her temper had not diminished with the passing of time, and when a passionate nature is not eased with moments of compassion, melodrama is likely to take the stage. In each outburst of anger, my mother was fair. She had the impartiality of nature, with the same lack of indulgence or clemency. Before we arrived from Arkansas, an incident took place that left the main actors in jail and in the hospital. Mother had a business partner, who may have been a little more than that, with whom she ran a restaurant cum gambling casino. The partner was not shouldering his portion of the responsibility, according to Mother, and when she confronted him, he became haughty and domineering, and he unforgivably called her a bitch. Now, everyone knew that although she cursed as freely as she laughed, no one cursed around her, and certainly no one cursed her. Maybe for the sake of business arrangements, she restrained a spontaneous reaction. She told her partner, "I'm going to be one bitch, and I've already been that one." In a foolhardy gesture, the man relieved himself of still another bitch, and Mother shot him. She had anticipated some trouble when she determined to speak to him, and so had taken the precaution to slip a little .32 in her big skirt pocket. Shot once, the partner stumbled toward her instead of away, and she said that since she had intended to shoot him, notice, shoot, not kill, she had no reason to run away, so she shot him a second time. It must have been a maddening situation for them. To her, each shot seemed to impel him forward, the reverse of her desire, and for him, the closer he got to her, the more she shot him. She stood her ground until he reached her and flung both arms around her neck, dragging her to the floor. She later said the police had to untwine him before he could be taken to the ambulance, and on the following day, when she was released on bail, she looked in the mirror and had black eyes down to here. In throwing his arms around her, he must have struck her. She bruised easily. The partner lived, though shot twice, and although the partnership was dissolved, they retained admiration for each other. He had been shot, true, but in her fairness, she had warned him, and he had had the strength to give her two black eyes and then live. Admirable qualities. World War II started on a Sunday afternoon when I was on my way to the movies. People in the streets shouted, "We're at war! We declared war on Japan!" I ran all the way home, not too sure I wouldn't be bombed before I reached Bailey and Mother. Grandmother Baxter calmed my anxiety by explaining that America would not be bombed, not as long as Franklin Delano Roosevelt was president. He was, after all, a politician's politician, and he knew what he was doing. Soon after, Mother married Daddy Clydell, who turned out to be the first father I would know. He was a successful businessman, and he and Mother moved us to San Francisco. Uncle Tommy, Uncle Billy, and Grandmother Baxter remained in the big house in Oakland. 27. In the early months of World War II, San Francisco's Fillmore District, or the Western Addition, experienced a visible revolution. On the surface, it appeared to be totally peaceful, and almost a refutation of the term revolution. The Yakamoto Seafood Market quietly became Sammy's Shoeshine Parlor and Smoke Shop. Yoshigira's Hardware metamorphosed into Le Salon de Beauté, owned by Miss Clorinda Jackson. The Japanese shops, which sold products to Nisei customers, were taken over by enterprising Negro businessmen, and in less than a year became permanent homes away from home for the newly arrived Southern blacks. Where the odors of tempura, raw fish, and cha had dominated, the aroma of chitlins, greens, and ham hocks now prevailed. The Asian population dwindled before my eyes. I was unable to tell the Japanese from the Chinese, and as yet found no real difference in the national origin of such sounds as Ching and Chan, or Moto and Kano. As the Japanese disappeared soundlessly and without protest, the Negroes entered with their loud jukeboxes, their just-released animosities, and the relief of escape from Southern bonds. The Japanese area became San Francisco's Harlem in a matter of months. A person unaware of all the factors that make up oppression might have expected sympathy or even support from the Negro newcomers for the dislodged Japanese, especially in view of the fact that they, the blacks, had themselves undergone concentration camp living for centuries in slavers' plantations and later in sharecroppers' cabins. But the sensations of common relationship were missing. The black newcomer had been recruited on the desiccated farmlands of Georgia and Mississippi by war plant labor scouts. The chance to live in two- or three-story apartment buildings, which became instant slums, and to earn two- and even three-figured weekly checks, was blinding. For the first time, he could think of himself as a boss, a spender. He was able to pay other people to work for him, i.e., the dry cleaners, taxi drivers, waitresses, etc. The shipyards and ammunition plants brought to booming life by the war let him know that he was needed and even appreciated, a completely alien yet very pleasant position for him to experience. Who could expect this man to share his new and dizzying importance with concern for a race that he had never known to exist? Another reason for his indifference to the Japanese removal was more subtle, but was more profoundly felt. The Japanese were not white folks. Their eyes, language, and customs belied the white skin and proved to their dark successors that since they didn't have to be feared, neither did they have to be considered. All this was decided unconsciously. No member of my family and none of the family friends ever mentioned the absent Japanese. It was as if they had never owned or lived in the houses we inhabited. On Post Street, where our house was, the hill skidded slowly down to Fillmore, the market heart of our district. In the two short blocks before it reached its destination, the street housed two day and night restaurants, two pool halls, four Chinese restaurants, two gambling houses, plus diners, shoeshine shops, beauty salons, barbershops, and at least four churches. To fully grasp the never-ending activity in San Francisco's Negro neighborhood during the war, one need only know that the two blocks described were side streets that were duplicated many times over in the 8 to 10 square block area. The air of collective displacement, the impermanence of life in wartime, and the gauche personalities of the more recent arrivals tended to dissipate my own sense of not belonging. In San Francisco, for the first time, I perceived myself as part of something. Not that I identified with the newcomers, nor with the rare black descendants of native San Franciscans, nor with the whites or even the Asians, but rather with the times and the city. I understood the arrogance of young sailors who marched the streets in marauding gangs, approaching every girl as if she were at best a prostitute and at worst an Axis agent bent on making the United States lose the war. The undertone of fear that San Francisco would be bombed, which was abetted by weekly air raid warnings and civil defense drills in school, heightened my sense of belonging. Hadn't I always, but ever and ever, thought that life was just one great big risk for the living? Then the city acted in wartime like an intelligent woman under siege. She gave what she couldn't with safety withhold, and secured those things which lay in her reach. The city became for me the ideal of what I wanted to be as a grown-up. Friendly but never gushing, cool but not frigid or distant, distinguished without the awful stiffness. To San Franciscans, the city that knows how was the Bay, the Fog, Sir Francis Drake Hotel, Top of the Mark, Chinatown, the Sunset District, and so on and so forth, and so white. To me, a 13-year-old black girl, stalled by the South and Southern black lifestyle, the city was a state of beauty and a state of freedom. The Fog wasn't simply the steamy vapors off the bay, caught and penned in by hills, but a soft breath of anonymity that shrouded and cushioned the bashful traveler. I became dauntless and free of fears, intoxicated by the physical fact of San Francisco. Safe in my protecting arrogance, I was certain that no one loved her as impartially as I. I walked around the Mark Hopkins and gazed at the Top of the Mark, but maybe sour grapes, was more impressed by the view of Oakland from the hill than by the tiered building or its fur-draped visitors. For weeks after the city and I came to terms about my belonging, I haunted the points of interest and found them empty and un-San Francisco. The naval officers, with their well-dressed wives and clean white babies, inhabited another time-space dimension than I. The well-kept old women in chauffeured cars and blonde girls in buckskin shoes and cashmere sweaters might have been San Franciscans, but they were at most gilt on the frame of my portrait of the city. Pride and prejudice stalked in tandem the beautiful hills. Native San Franciscans, possessive of the city, had to cope with an influx not of awed, respectful tourists, but of raucous, unsophisticated provincials. They were also forced to live with skin-deep guilt brought on by the treatment of their former Nisei schoolmates. Southern white illiterates brought their biases intact to the West from the hills of Arkansas and the swamps of Georgia. The black ex-farmers had not left their distrust and fear of whites, which history had taught them in distressful lessons. These two groups were obliged to work side by side in the war plans, and their animosities festered and opened like boils on the face of the city. San Franciscans would have sworn on the Golden Gate Bridge that racism was missing from the heart of their air-conditioned city, but they would have been sadly mistaken. A story went the rounds about a San Franciscan white matron who refused to sit beside a Negro civilian on the streetcar, even after he made room for her on the seat. Her explanation was that she would not sit beside a draft dodger who was a Negro as well. She added that the least he could do was fight for his country, the way her son was fighting on Iwo Jima. The story said that the man pulled his body away from the window to show an armless sleeve. He said quietly and with great dignity, "Then ask your son to look around for my arm, which I left over there." 28. Although my grades were very good, I had been put up 2 semesters on my arrival from Stamps. I found myself unable to settle down in the high school. It was an institution for girls near my house, and the young ladies were faster, brasher, meaner, and more prejudiced than any I had met at Lafayette County Training School. Many of the Negro girls were, like me, straight from the South, but they had known, or claimed to have known, the bright lights of Big D, Dallas, or T-Town, Tulsa, Oklahoma, and their language bore up their claims. They strutted with an aura of invincibility, and along with some of the Mexican students who put knives in their tall pompadours, they absolutely intimidated the white girls and those black and Mexican students who had no shield of fearlessness. Fortunately, I was transferred to George Washington High School. The beautiful building sat on a moderate hill in the white residential district, some 60 blocks from the Negro neighborhood. For the first semester, I was one of 3 black students in the school. And in that rarefied atmosphere, I came to love my people more. Mornings, as the streetcar traversed my ghetto, I experienced a mixture of dread and trauma. I knew that all too soon we would be out of my familiar setting, and blacks who were on the streetcar when I got on would all be gone, and I alone would face the 40 blocks of neat streets, smooth lawns, white houses, and rich children. In the evenings on the way home, the sensations were joy, anticipation, and relief at the first sign which said barbecue, or do drop in, or home cooking, or at the first brown faces on the streets. I recognized I was again in my country. In the school itself, I was disappointed to find that I was not the most brilliant, or even nearly the most brilliant student. The white kids had better vocabularies than I, and what was more appalling, less fear in the classrooms. They never hesitated to hold up their hands in response to a teacher's question. Even when they were wrong aggressively. While I had to be certain about all my facts before I dared to call attention to myself. George Washington High School was the first real school I attended. My entire stay there might have been time lost if it hadn't been for the unique personality of a brilliant teacher. Miss Curran was that rare educator who was in love with information. I will always believe that her love of teaching came not so much from her liking for students, but from her desire to make sure that some of the things she knew would find repositories so that they could be shared again. She and her maiden sister worked in the San Francisco City school system for over 20 years. My Miss Curran, who was a tall, florid, buxom lady with battleship gray hair, taught civics and current events. At the end of a term in her class, our books were as clean and the pages as stiff as they had been when they were issued to us. Miss Curran's students were never, or very rarely, called upon to open textbooks. She greeted each class with, "Good day, ladies and gentlemen." I had never heard an adult speak with such respect to teenagers. Adults usually believe that a show of honor diminishes their authority. In today's Chronicle, there was an article on the mining industry in the Carolinas, or some such distant subject. I am certain that all of you have read the article. I would like someone to elaborate on the subject for me. After the first 2 weeks in her class, I, along with all the other excited students, read the San Francisco newspapers, Time magazine, Life, and everything else available to me. Miss Curran proved Bailey right. He had told me once that all knowledge is spendable currency, depending on the market. There were no favorite students, no teacher's pets. If a student pleased her during a particular period, he could not count on special treatment in the next day's class, and that was as true the other way around. Each day she faced us with a clean slate and acted as if ours were clean as well. Reserved and firm in her opinions, she spent no time in indulging the frivolous. She was stimulating instead of intimidating. Where some of the other teachers went out of their way to be nice to me, to be a liberal with me, and others ignored me completely, Miss Curran never seemed to notice that I was black and therefore different. I was Miss Johnson, and if I had the answer to a question she posed, I was never given any more than the word correct, which was what she said to every other student with the correct answer. Years later, when I returned to San Francisco, I made visits to her classroom. She always remembered that I was Miss Johnson, who had a good mind and should be doing something with it. I was never encouraged on those visits to loiter or linger about her desk. She acted as if I must have had other visits to make. I often wondered if she knew she was the only teacher I remembered. I never knew why I was given a scholarship to the California Labor School. It was a college for adults, and many years later, I found that it was on the House Un-American Activities list of subversive organizations. At 14, I accepted a scholarship and got one for the next year as well. In the evening classes, I took drama and dance, along with white and black grown-ups. I had chosen drama simply because I liked Hamlet's soliloquy, beginning, "To be or not to be." I had never seen a play and did not connect movies with the theater. In fact, the only times I had heard the soliloquy had been when I had melodramatically recited to myself in front of a mirror. It was hard to curb my love for the exaggerated gesture and the emotive voice. When Bailey and I read poems together, he sounded like a fierce Basil Rathbone, and I like a maddened Bette Davis. At the California Labor School, a forceful and perceptive teacher quickly and unceremoniously separated me from melodrama. She made me do 6 months of pantomime. Bailey and mother encouraged me to take dance, and he privately told me that the exercise would make my legs big and widen my hips. I needed no greater inducement. My shyness at moving clad in black tights around a large empty room did not last long. Of course, at first I thought everyone would be staring at my cucumber-shaped body with its knobs for knees, knobs for elbows, and alas, knobs for breasts. But they really did not notice me. And when the teacher floated across the floor and finished in an arabesque, my fancy was taken. I would learn to move like that. I would learn to, in her words, occupy space. My days angled off Miss Kerwin's class, dinner with Bailey and mother, and drama and dance. The allegiances I owed at this time in my life would have made very strange bedfellows. Mama with her solemn determination, Mrs. Flowers and her books, Bailey with his love, my mother and her gaiety, Miss Kerwin and her information, my evening classes of drama and dance. 29. Our house was a 14-room, typical San Franciscan post-earthquake affair. We had a succession of rumors, bringing and taking their different accents and personalities and foods. Shipyard workers clanked up the stairs. We all slept on the second floor except Mother and Daddy Clydell, in their steel-tipped boots and metal hats, and gave way to much powdered prostitutes who giggled through their makeup and hung their wigs on the doorknobs. One couple, they were college graduates, held long adult conversations with me in the big kitchen downstairs, until the husband went off to war. Then the wife, who had been so charming and ready to smile, changed into a silent shadow that played infrequently along the walls. An older couple lived with us for a year or so. They owned a restaurant and had no personality to enchant or interest a teenager, except that the husband was called Uncle Jim, and the wife, Aunt Boy. I never figured that out. The quality of strength, lined with tenderness, is an unbeatable combination, as are intelligence and necessity, when unblunted by formal education. I was prepared to accept Daddy Clydell as one more faceless name added to Mother's roster of conquest. I had trained myself so successfully through the years to display interest, or at least attention, while my mind skipped free on other subjects, that I could have lived in his house without ever seeing him, and without his becoming the wiser. But his character beckoned and elicited admiration. He was a simple man, who had no inferiority complex about his lack of education, and even more amazing, no superiority complex because he had succeeded despite that lack. He would say often, "I've been to school 3 years in my life. In Slayton, Texas, times was hard, and I had to help my daddy on the farm." No recriminations lay hidden under the plain statement, nor was there boasting when he said, "If I'm living a little better now, it's because I treats everybody right." He owned apartment buildings and later pool halls, and was famous for being that rarity, a man of honor. he didn't suffer as many honest men do from the detestable righteousness that diminishes their virtue. He knew cards and men's hearts. So during the age when Mother was exposing us to certain facts of life, like personal hygiene, proper posture, table manners, good restaurants, and tipping practices, Daddy Clydell taught me to play poker, blackjack, tonk, and high-low jig-jack in the game. He wore expensively tailored suits and a large yellow diamond stick pin. Except for the jewelry, he was a conservative dresser and carried himself with the unconscious pomp of a man of secure means. Unexpectedly, I resembled him, and when he, Mother, and I walked down the street, his friends often said, "Clydell, that's sure your daughter. Ain't no way you can deny her." Proud laughter followed those declarations, for he had never had children. Because of his late arriving, but intense paternal sense, I was introduced to the most colorful characters in the black underground. One afternoon, I was invited into our smoke-filled dining room to make the acquaintance of Stonewall Jimmy, Just Black, Cool Clyde, Tight Coat, and Red Leg. Daddy Clydell explained to me that they were the most successful con men in the world, and they were going to tell me about some games so that I would never be anybody's mark. To begin, one man warned me, "There ain't never been a mark yet that didn't want something for nothing." Then they took turns showing me their tricks, how they chose their victims, marks, from the wealthy, bigoted whites, and in every case, how they used the victim's prejudice against them. Some of the tales were funny, a few were pathetic, but all were amusing or gratifying to me, for the black man, the con man, who could act the most stupid, won out every time over the powerful, arrogant white. I remember Mr. Redleg's story like a favorite melody. Anything that works against you can also work for you once you understand the principle of reverse. There was a cracker in Tulsa who bilked so many Negroes he could set up a Negro bilking company. Naturally, he got to thinking, black skin means damn fool. Just Black and I went to Tulsa to check him out. Come to find out, he's a perfect mark. His mama must have been scared in an Indian massacre in Africa. He hated Negroes only a little more than he despised Indians. And he was greedy. Black and I studied him and decided he was worth setting up against the store. That means we were ready to pull out a few thousand dollars in preparation. We pulled in a white boy from New York, a good con artist, and had him open an office in Tulsa. He was supposed to be a northern real estate agent trying to buy up valuable land in Oklahoma. We investigated a piece of land near Tulsa that had a toll bridge crossing it. It used to be part of an Indian reservation, but had been taken over by the state. Just Black was laid out as a decoy, and I was going to be the fool. After our friend from New York hired a secretary and had his cards printed, Black approached the mark with a proposition. He told him that he had heard that our mark was the only white man colored people could trust. He named some of the poor fools that had been taken by that crook. It just goes to show you how white folks can be deceived by their own deception. The mark believed Black. Black told him about his friend, who was half Indian and half colored, and how some northern white estate agent had found out that he was the sole owner of a piece of valuable land, and the northerner wanted to buy it. At first, the man acted like he smelled a rat, but from the way he gobbled up the proposition, turns out what he thought he smelled was some nigger money on his top lip. He asked the whereabouts of the land, but Black put him off. He told his cracker that he just wanted to make sure that he would be interested. The mark allowed how he was being interested, so Black said he would tell his friend and they'd get in touch with him. Black met the mark for about 3 weeks in cars and in alleys and kept putting him off until the white man was almost crazy with anxiety and greed. And then accidentally, it seemed, Black let drop the name of the northern real estate agent who wanted the property. From that moment on, we knew we had the big fish on the line, and all we had to do was pull him in. We expected him to try to contact our store, which he did. That cracker went to our setup and counted on his whiteness to ally him with Spots, our white boy. But Spots refused to talk about the deal, except to say the land had been thoroughly investigated by the biggest real estate concern in the South, and that if our mark did not go around raising dust, he would make sure that there would be a nice piece of money in it for him. Any obvious inquiries as to the rightful ownership of the land could alert the state, and they would surely push through a law prohibiting the sale. Spots told the mark he would keep in touch with him. The mark went back to the store 3 or 4 times, but to no avail. Then, just before we knew he would crack, Black brought me to see him. That fool was as happy as a sissy in a CCC camp. You would have thought my neck was in a noose and he was about to light the fire under my feet. I never enjoyed taking anybody so much. Anyhow, I played scary at first, but just Black told me that this was one white man that our people could trust. I said I did not trust no white man because all they wanted was to get a chance to kill a Black man legally and get his wife in the bed. I'm sorry, Clydell. The mark assured me that he was the only white man who did not feel like that. Some of his best friends were colored people. In fact, if I didn't know it, the woman who raised him was a colored woman, and he still sees her to this day. I let myself be convinced. And then the mark began to drag the northern whites. He told me that they made Negroes sleep in the street in the north, and that they had to clean out toilets with their hands in the north, and even things worse than that. I was shocked and said, then I don't want to sell my land to that white man who offered $75,000 for it. Just Black said I wouldn't know what to do with that kind of money. And I said that all I wanted was to have enough money to buy a home for my old mom, to buy a business, and to make one trip to Harlem. The mark asked, how much would that cost? And I said, I reckon I could do it on $50,000. The mark told me no Negro was safe with that kind of money, that white folks would take it from him. I said, I knew it, but I had to have at least $40,000. He agreed. We shook hands. I said it would do my heart good to see the mean Yankee go down on some of our land. We met the next morning, and I signed the deed in his car, and he gave me the cash. Black and I kept most of our things in a hotel over in Hot Springs, Arkansas. When the deal was closed, we walked to our car, drove across the state line, and on to Hot Springs. That was all there was to it. When he finished, more triumphant stories rainbowed around the room. riding the shoulders of laughter. By all accounts, those storytellers, born black and male, before the turn of the 20th century, should have been ground into useless dust. Instead, they used their intelligence to pry open the door of rejection, and not only became wealthy, but got some revenge in the bargain. It wasn't possible for me to regard them as criminals or be anything but proud of their achievements. The needs of a society determine its ethics, and in the black American ghettos, the hero is that man who is offered only the crumbs from his country's table, but by ingenuity and courage is able to take for himself a Lucullan feast. Hence the janitor who lives in one room but sports a robin's egg blue Cadillac is not laughed at, but admired. And the domestic who buys $40 shoes is not criticized, but is appreciated. We know that they have put to use their full mental and physical powers. Each single gain feeds into the gains of the body collective. Stories of law violations are weighed on a different set of scales in the black mind than in the white. Petty crimes embarrass the community, and many people wistfully wonder why Negroes don't rob more banks, embezzle more funds, and employ graft in the unions. We are the victims of the world's most comprehensive robbery. Life demands a balance. It's all right if we do a little robbing now. This belief appeals particularly to one who is unable to compete legally with his fellow citizens. My education and that of my black associates were quite different from the education of our white schoolmates. In the classroom, we all learned past participles. But in the streets and in our homes, the blacks learned to drop S's from plurals and suffixes from past tense verbs. We were alert to the gap separating the written word from the colloquial. We learned to slide out of one language and into another without being conscious of the effort. At school, in a given situation, we might respond with, "That's not unusual." But in the street, meeting the same situation, we easily said, "It be like that sometimes." 30. Just like Jane Withers and Donald O'Connor, I was going on a vacation. Daddy Bailey invited me to spend the summer with him in Southern California, and I was jumpy with excitement. Given our father's characteristic air of superiority, I secretly expected him to live in a manor house surrounded by grounds and serviced by a liveried staff. Mother was all cooperation in helping me to shop for summer clothes, with the haughtiness San Franciscans have for people who live in the warmer climate. She explained that all I needed were lots of shorts, pedal pushers, sandals, and blouses, because Southern Californians hardly wear anything else. Daddy Bailey had a girlfriend who had begun corresponding with me some months before, and she was to meet me at the train. We had agreed to wear white carnations to identify each other, and the porter kept my flower in the diner's frigidaire until we reached the small hot town. On the platform, my eyes skimmed over the whites and searched among the Negroes who were walking up and down expectantly. There were no men as tall as Daddy, and no really glamorous ladies. I had decided that given his first choice, all his succeeding women would be startlingly beautiful. I saw a little girl who wore a white flower but dismissed her as improbable. The platform emptied as we walked by each other time after time. Finally, she stopped me with a disbelieving, "Marguerite?" Her voice screeched with shock and maturity. So, after all, she wasn't a little girl. I, too, was visited with unbelief. She said, "I'm Dolores Stockland." Stunned but trying to be well-mannered, I said, "Hello, my name is Marguerite." "Daddy's girlfriend?" I guessed her to be in her early 20s. Her crisp seersucker suit, spectator pumps, and gloves informed me that she was proper and serious. She was of average height, but with the unformed body of a girl. And I thought, if she was planning to marry our father, she must have been horrified to find herself with a nearly 6-foot prospective stepdaughter who is not even pretty. I found later that Daddy Bailey had told her that his children were 8 and 9 years old and cute as buttons. She had such a need to believe in him that even though we corresponded at a time when I loved the multisyllabic words and convoluted sentences, she had been able to ignore the obvious. I was another link in a long chain of disappointments. Daddy had promised to marry her, but kept delaying until he finally married a woman named Alberta, who was another small, tight woman from the South. When I met Dolores, she had all the poses of the black bourgeoisie, without the material basis to support the postures. Instead of owning a manor house and servants, Daddy lived in a trailer park on the outskirts of a town that was itself the outskirts of town. Dolores lived there with him and kept the house clean with the orderliness of a coffin. Artificial flowers reposed waxily in glass vases. She was on close terms with her washing machine and ironing board. Her hairdresser could count on absolute fidelity and punctuality. In a word, but for intrusions, her life would have been perfect. And then I came along. She tried hard to make me into something she could reasonably accept. Her first attempt, which failed utterly, concerned my attention to details. I was asked, cajoled, then ordered to care for my room. My willingness to do so was hampered by an abounding ignorance of how it should be done and a fumbling awkwardness with small objects. The dresser in my room was covered with little porcelain white women holding parasols, china dogs, fat-bellied cupids, and blown glass animals of every persuasion. After making the bed, sweeping my room, and hanging up the clothes, if and when I remembered to dust the bric-a-brac, I unfailingly held one too tightly and crunched off a leg or two, or too loosely, and dropped it to shatter it into miserable pieces. Daddy wore his amused, impenetrable face constantly. He seemed positively diabolic in his enjoyment of our discomfort. Certainly Dolores adored her outside's lover and his elocution. Daddy Bailey never spoke. He orated. Spiced with the rolling errs and errors, must have been some consolation to her in their less than middle-class home. He worked in the kitchen of a naval hospital, and they both said he was a medical dietitian for the United States Navy. Their Frigidaire was always stocked with newly acquired pieces of ham, half roast, and quartered chickens. Dad was an excellent cook. He had been in France during World War I and had also worked as a doorman at the exclusive Breakers Hotel. As a